Welcome to JGL Law for You. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will be discussing a wide array of topics to help you navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. I am really excited today. We have one of the deans, really one of the deans of medical malpractice law in the United States, recognized as one of the nation's leading malpractice attorneys. He's recovered tens of millions of dollars for his clients over the years. He lectures nationwide across the country to legal audience. He's a founder of the Birth Trauma Litigation Group, the American Trial Lawyers, and not coincidentally, the founder of my favorite law firm, Joseph Greenwald & Lake. Andy Greenwald, welcome aboard today.
Thank you.
Really happy to have you. And I want to start with a really simple question for you that a lot of folks who are not lawyers would like to hear the answer to. Doctors, you know, are there to take care of us, Andy. And why would anybody consider filing a lawsuit or seeking recovery against a doctor or a hospital when these are the folks who are trained to take care of us?
Well, because things have changed a lot in how people view the medical profession. For example, I have many, many people who come to see me. Why? Because they can't get an answer. They can't find out what happened to them or to their child. They call and they never get a call back. Someone who has a gallbladder problem goes to the hospital and they're now the gallbladder in room 507. They're no longer Mrs. Jones. And there has been a decrease in the relationship in many areas. And so a lot of people come not because they're looking to sue initially, but because they can't get an answer as to what happened. And they want to know why they have this problem or their child has this problem.
So if I come to you, you know, client X, whatever my name is, and I come to you and I've been trying to figure out what happened to my son who passed away in the hospital or my daughter, what do you do? What is it that you do to try to find the answers that I'm looking for?
Well, the first thing we do when we meet with the clients is to go over with them what they believe happened and get a history of what went on. The second thing we do is explain to them what medical malpractice is. It's the failure of a medical professional to comply with the standard of care. All that means is to do what a reasonably competent practitioner should do when they have a patient like this person. And so we want to find out whether or not they complied with appropriate standards of care. So we get a HIPAA form from the client after they've retained us. And
what's that mean? What's that? What's a HIPAA form?
A HIPAA form is a form that the client signs that gives us permission to get their medical records.
Okay.
So we get the medical records, and we also get copies of any films that may be taken, x-rays, MRI films. And we in-house go through a complete analysis of what happened. We put together a timeline. And after we do that and understand everything that happened, I will then call a physician in the area that we're involved with and just get an offhand view of what they think about the facts that we've established and what happened. Let's take a case, for example, and go through realistically.
Terrific. Good.
I have done a lot of obstetrical malpractice cases where I have represented brain-injured children and children who have had significant problems and disabilities, including cerebral palsy, as a result of obstetrical negligence. So in a case like that, we will sit down with the parents, go over what happened, get their perspective of what happened, and we will want to know, was the labor difficult? Did it take a long time? Did the mother have an infection? Was the mother preeclamptic? Did she have high blood pressure? Did the doctor come and see the patient in the hospital? How much time did the doctor spend with the patient during labor? Did the labor go on longer than anticipated? We will get a copy of the fetal monitor strip, which is a strip that is attached to the mother and the baby, which monitors the mother's heart rate and the baby's heart rate. We will get all of that information, and then we will determine from talking to family members, many of whom are extremely helpful because they have been in the delivery room at the time the delivery took place. I've had cases where doctors required that family members leave the room because of what was going on. So we get all of that information, and then we want to know, in a baby case, if the baby is not normal, what was the baby like in the newborn period? What happened to the baby? What was the baby's oxygen situation? Did the baby have seizures? Did they do MRIs of the baby's brain? We will need those MRI films to have a pediatric neuroradiologist look at them to determine whether or not there is an injury to the brain and when, more likely than not, did that injury occur. We'll take the fetal monitor strip and we'll show it to obstetrical experts and ask them to tell us what happened during the labor. I've done enough of these cases that I have a fairly good idea when I look at a fetal monitor strip what it shows. I remember when my granddaughter was born, my wife said, "Don't scare them." So I have a pretty good idea generally, but we have experts look at them and tell us what exactly happened. Did the baby suffer from lack of oxygen during labor that should have been remedied? Was the baby delivered on time? Should the baby have had an emergency C-section? These are all questions that come up depending on the situation and what the baby was like.
This is an extensive investigation you're doing when I come into your office or after this client comes into your office. So it's more than just you, obviously, right? It's all these experts who are going to look at these different areas of what is a potential negligence case. So my question to you is, you know, I take it you don't take every case that comes in the door, right?
No, I only take about 5 or 6% of the cases that I take.
Okay.
I actually have lectured to doctors on how to avoid malpractice. And I say to them, you know who I am? I'm the person that tells most of your patients you did a good job. Because I only take about 6 or 7% of the cases. And that's why I can tell you that most people come to see me because they can't get an answer.
Uh-huh. So let's keep going. I interrupt you. So you're in the midst of this investigation, which has a lot of tentacles, obviously, to it. Take us from there.
Yes, and we have a paralegal who specializes in this. So once we have all of that information, okay, we will talk to different experts. The first expert we'll talk to is an obstetrician to determine whether or not that obstetrician believes that the labor was appropriately handled, that the baby was timely delivered, and that the way the baby delivered was appropriate. I've had cases where babies were injured by forceps. I've had cases where babies were injured by vacuum extractors. And so all of those things are relevant to look at.
Andy, let me ask you this question. Anybody who goes into a hospital, whether they're being treated for something or if they're having a baby, there's inherent risks, right? To just any reason anyone comes into a hospital. How do you evaluate, you know, something that is not outside the realm of what might happen or a risk that is just inherent in a particular procedure, in this case, in the birth of a child? Look at that versus what might be some negligence on behalf of one or more of the healthcare providers.
Well, there are certain things that are pretty standard that you know in a case like this. For example, you know what the fetal monitor strip looks like. You can look at the strip and see whether the baby is being asphyxiated. You can look and see if the baby is being deprived of oxygen that needs to be straightened out quickly. You can see whether the baby needs to be delivered immediately. If you look at the way the baby was delivered, if you have a child that has an injury to the arm, for example, there are a number of those cases where the brachial plexus is injured permanently and the arm kind of just hangs down. So you look at how the baby was delivered, what kind of maneuvers were used to deliver the baby, how much effort and strength was put on the baby's head and the baby's neck. So these are all things that you look at and obviously come from experience in dealing with these types of cases. So once we have all of that information and I talk to an obstetrician and the obstetrician says, no, this is not negligence because of such and such, we'll sit down with the client and we'll explain to them exactly what happened. The obstetrician says, yes, this is never should have happened this way. We'll explain that also. The parents can then make a decision as to whether they want to proceed or not. Because you have to recognize that if you have a child who has significant brain injury, the future cost to take care of that child is in the millions of dollars. Okay? And that baby is entitled to the best medical care available. Not just something that they'll get from the state, but the best medical care available if that injury is a result of someone's negligence.
So here we are in your office. You've done your investigation. How much have I paid you for all of this work up to this point? How much does somebody pay you? You know, when they come in and you're, you know, you're talking to experts, you're looking at records. It sounds expensive.
Actually, it's not expensive at all because we don't charge to investigate the case. So there is no charge to the client for us doing all of that work and making a determination as to whether or not there is a case that should proceed.
So it's sort of a no lose for the potential client, right? Because they're getting their answer, the answers that they're looking for, without a real financial risk or worry that they're going to have to write a check for thousands of dollars to look into it.
You know, I've told many, many parents that you don't have to file a lawsuit if you don't want to, but if your child is severely injured, you really owe it to the child to find out whether the child has rights. And you can then make whatever decisions you want to make once you know the answer to that question. So let me just say, let's assume that we have now gone through all of this. I've had an obstetrician look at how the obstetrical care was. We now need to determine the second part of a malpractice case. And that is, was the negligence of the doctors the cause of the baby's injury? Because that's the second part of how you do a malpractice case. So in order to do that, we talk to neonatologists, who are doctors that take care of newborns, child neurologists about the baby's brain and the situation the baby's in. And we have the films looked at by a pediatric neuroradiologist who specializes in the brain of newborns. And we ask those people what actually caused the problem that this child has. Because there are situations where the problem was not preventable. And we certainly don't want to proceed on a case against a physician or a hospital and take parents through that procedure if they didn't cause the injury to the child.
So this is that link that you're talking about between what appears to be negligence on some healthcare provider's part and the damages that have now been sustained by this young child. There has to be some connection between the two of them.
You have to be able to prove more likely than not that the negligence caused the injury to the patient. And if you can't prove that, you don't have a case to proceed with. Because there are some things that can happen. A baby can have a stroke in utero, may have nothing to do with any negligence. So these are all issues that you need to look at. You don't want to start down the road of a lawsuit, which not only then becomes expensive in paying experts and taking parents through an emotional roller coaster, if you're not sure what happened and you're not sure of how the injury occurred.
Let's shift to the next stage. So you've met with the family. You believe that there was negligence. There was causal connection between the negligence and the injury, the damages sustained by this child. And you've decided to move forward with the case. What do you tell me? What happens next? What do we do?
Well, the next thing that happens is, of course, it depends where the case is, because different states have different qualifications.
Okay.
I've done obstetrical cases in a lot of different states, from Maryland, Virginia, Oklahoma, Washington State. I mean, I've done them in a lot of places because a lot of lawyers have called me and asked for my help. So depending on the requirements of the various jurisdiction, but normally we would prepare a lawsuit and we would file a lawsuit against the negligent parties. In an obstetrical case, it may be the doctors. It may also be the hospital. The nurses may have not called the doctors timely when they should have. The nurses may have not paid attention to the fetal monitor strip. The nurses may not have known how to read the fetal monitor strip, which is even worse. So there may be more than one party involved in the case. So the case is then filed, and the other side has an amount of time to respond and file an answer, which answers the allegations that we have written in the lawsuit. Now, after that happens, we go into what's called the discovery phase of the case. We sit down and take the depositions. That means we sit and question the people who we believe were responsible for what happened here. And we have a right to question them under oath as to what happened. They have a right to question our clients and their family members or witnesses who have observed what happened. After that, the court sets a period of time when each side has to name their experts. So in a case like this, for example, we would probably have two obstetrical experts. Why do I say two? Because when I first started doing this, if we could find one doctor who would testify, the other side would say, well, there's always one screwball in every group, and Greenwald found them. Well, it's a lot harder to find two screwballs than it is one. So we would have two of those. We would have a child neurologist. We would have a pediatric neuroradiologist. We would have a life care planner, which is someone who will go over with the doctors everything that the child needs for the rest of the child's life, medical, all other kinds of care, and will present us with a report as to the cost of all of those things for the child's life. And then that stuff then goes to an economist who has to give an opinion as to what the actual present value cost would be to take care of this child for the rest of the child's life. So there are a lot of experts involved in this type of a case. So we name our experts, and we would have to give the other side a description of what they're going to say. They have to do the same thing to us, name their experts and give us a description of what they're going to say.
While this is all going on, and while you change your experts and they're deposing them and asking questions and so forth, briefly, what are the defense lawyers doing? What are they trying to do to muddy the waters, to make it more difficult for you to have success in this litigation on behalf of your clients?
Well, the defense attorneys will go out and find experts who will say that everything was okay. You know, interestingly enough,
they'll find screwballs of their own, in other words.
Well, interestingly enough, in this area, sometimes when I do these cases, I can pretty much tell you who the defense is going to use. Mm-hmm. Because at one point in time, there was a child neurologist at a local children's hospital who I had deposed so many times that he said to me in one case, why don't I depose you and you answer the questions? We know what we're going to say to each other.
So they're looking to find support for their position, I take it, in some fashion that either goes to the fact that there wasn't negligence, goes to the fact that if there was negligence, it didn't cause the injury, or maybe that the injuries are not as significant or the cost of future care isn't as significant.
Well, they do that, but the other thing they do in these cases is they try to look for a genetic abnormality in the child that they can argue that it didn't matter that we were negligent because this child was going to be like this anyway. Uh-huh. Okay. And there are certain genetic syndromes of which people are not sure what's what, that they will run and try to produce to show that this child is going to be like that. For example, I had a case many years ago where the child had a very large head. And so the defense was that the child had a syndrome because of the large head. And they got this geneticist who was world famous from, I think he was at Iowa or Indiana University. And I said to him in his deposition, your opinion is that this child is brain damaged because his head was so big. Aren't there people with big heads? And he said, yes. And I said, do you have any grandchildren that look like you? And he said, yes. And I said, why? And he explained about the genetics. And I said, well, in your desire to be complete in this case, when did you ask the defense attorney what this boy's grandpa looks like? And he looked at me and he said, well, I didn't. And I said, well, if I was to tell you that when his grandpa was in the army, his nickname was Pumpkinhead because he had the biggest head in the group and they had to get a special hat for him, could it be that this boy looks like his grandpa, like your grandkids look like you? And he said, well, I guess that certainly is possible. Mm-hmm. So the point I'm making is that you really need to understand what's involved in these cases and where people are going. And we rely a lot on our experts to help us when we get defenses that don't seem to make a lot of sense. So there's an example of
what. All right, so now take me to, all right, and I know I'm interrupting you yet again, but now we're at the point where you know what they're going to say. They know what you're going to say. Do we now have to have a trial, or is there any other way to get my
case
resolved?
The courts now require mediation. That's a procedure where both sides go to a mediator, and the mediator can either be somebody that both sides agree to, or it can be someone that the court appoints to mediate. I have found in my experience, usually we all agree, meaning the plaintiff and the defendant side, to who the mediator is. Because the mediation is worthless if the person who's mediating doesn't understand the intricacies of everything that's involved. Mm-hmm. So we're required to mediate. Quite frankly, I never thought mediation was going to be that good or was going to really work out that well, but it's been exactly the opposite. I have settled innumerable cases in mediation, some that I thought would never settle. And so we go to a mediation, and the client and the lawyers for each side are in different rooms. Now they're all being done by Zoom. And the mediator comes in and says, goes over the case, because you have to give the mediator in advance a statement of what the case is about from your perspective, which the mediator does not share with the other side. And the mediator then comes in and talks to you about what he thinks about your case. He goes in the other room and talks to them about what he thinks of their case. He then asks the plaintiff, what is your demand to settle this case? How much money do you want not to have a trial? And a lot of times, lawyers will come up with a number. I don't actually do that necessarily at first, because I'd like to know whether the other side is serious about trying to settle the case. The fact that they have to mediate doesn't mean they have to settle. Those are two different things. So the mediator will then tell us, you know, what that person thinks is a good number. We talk to the client about it, and the parties go back and forth trying to settle the case. And a lot of times it's successful.
Are the clients are present at the mediation, whether it's in person?
Clients are present at the mediation, and the defendants and their insurance company representatives are present.
Okay.
And at the mediation.
And all right, so let's take a moment and talk about what happens if the case doesn't settle at mediation, efforts to resolve it have failed, and now we're getting ready to go into a courtroom. Give our folks out there a quick thumbnail of what a trial is going to look like.
Well, the trial, the first thing that happens is a jury is picked. Depending on the jurisdiction that you're in, in Maryland and D.C., the lawyers really don't have a right to question the prospective jurors. They can give the judge a list of questions to ask, because you want to make sure that the people who sit on the jury don't have certain biases that would affect how they would feel about the case. In some jurisdictions, the lawyers can question the jurors directly. So it depends on where we are. Each side has a number of strikes. They don't have to give a reason why they strike the person from the jury. And then the jury is chosen. Once the jury is chosen, the judge gives them instructions about what the case is about and what their function is as a jury. The next thing that happens is the plaintiff puts on an opening statement. So I will get up and explain to the jury what this case is about and explain to them what the negligence is and what we're going to prove in the case. The other side will get up and talk about why everything I said is wrong. And that's what they'll do in their opening statement. Then witnesses are called to testify. The order of witnesses is a strategic question depending on how you want to do the case. Sometimes the first witness is the defendant called by the plaintiff. Sometimes that isn't the case. So the witnesses are called and they are then cross-examined by the other side. And then sometimes the cross-examination takes a long time, because the lawyer who's questioning the witness just keeps going. I personally think that's a mistake. There are people who have studied these issues, and they talk about what's called primacy and recency. There are those who believe that jurors make up their mind at the beginning when they hear what the case is about, and they're never going to change their mind no matter what happens during the trial. There are others who believe that that's not necessarily the case. And so the relationship of the lawyer to the jury is the subject of a whole other topic dealing with the question of persuasion. So the witnesses testify, the witnesses are cross-examined, and then final arguments take place, and the plaintiff advises, tells the jury why they should find for the plaintiff. The defendant gets up and says why what the plaintiff said is a bunch of garbage. The plaintiff then has rebuttal. He can get back up and rebut what the defense says, and that's because the plaintiff has what's called the burden of proof. The patient and the client have to show more likely than not that they are correct. If the evidence is equal, the plaintiff loses. So the plaintiff has to prove that their evidence is more weighty than the evidence of the defense. The judge then gives instructions to the jury. The instructions are argued by both sides. Some don't like some of the instructions, some want other instructions. The jury then goes out and deliberates on the case. When they reach a verdict, they come in and they announce what the verdict is. Now, cases get settled a lot during the trial.
I was going to ask you that.
Because the plaintiff puts on his case and some of his experts may not be as good as he thought they were going to be. Mm-hmm. And he gets nervous about what's going to happen. The defendant puts on their experts and the plaintiff destroys them in cross-examination. And so they're nervous about what's going to happen. There's also a thing called the high-low settlement, where neither side wants to run the risk of having a really bad result come out of this case, the huge amount that the plaintiff's looking for.
These are contracts that are enforceable, agreements that are signed by counsel on behalf of their clients?
Yeah, well, it's only with the agreement of the clients, and the jury is never told about this, obviously.
Right.
Neither
obviously.
Is the judge.
Okay.
So the jury then deliberates the case. And, you know, a famous trial lawyer in New York once in lecturing about this said, the jury cried when they went out. The jury cried when they came back in. The jury cried when they found for the doctor. So you never know,
yeah.
Exactly what's going to happen. Now, sometimes the cross-examination, you know, of the experts can destroy a case. I mean, if you go too much and you're too long, the shortest cross-examination I ever did in my entire life in a trial was probably a minute and a half. And the defense expert was there and it had to do with a doctor who missed cancer on a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. And I said to their expert, doctor, you don't really have an opinion in this case, do you? And he said, well, I just testified to my opinion. I said, I know, but you weren't there when the defendant did the examination. You don't know if he looked where he should have looked or he didn't look where he should have looked. You have no idea, do you? And he looked at me and he said, no more than you do, Mr. Greenwald. And I said, well, I'm just a lawyer. And if you don't know more than me, I don't have any more questions. That whole cross-examination was about a minute and a half.
That's terrific. Andy, I want to thank you so much for spending the time. I think we could probably spend another 2 hours together. For the people out there, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you and talk to you, talk about what might be a case or ask you about other types of cases?
Well, you know, just because I talked about the obstetrical case, I've done surgery cases, radiology cases, you name it. I've done suits against drug companies. So we're not limited. I just use this as an example.
Yeah, I think it was terrific. Very helpful to understand how the case flows from point A to point Z. And you do a lot more than just these baby cases. And if I'm someone listening out there, how would I get hold of you?
You could call the office at 301-220-2200, ask for Marion, who's my secretary, and Marion will arrange a time for us to have an informal chat about any issue that you have.
Terrific. Again, I want to thank you so much for being here. For folks out there, give this a listen and maybe a second listen because there's some awesome information here. We hope you join us next time. I am David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.